Here's Norm.
Thank you. Welcome to this morning's sessions. I did have an announcement to make for the rest of the, not for the workshop that follows after this that goes through the beginning of July. KITP is asking us for a logo, a picture of some sort, and the organizers have been sort of disorganized, so we haven't come up with a good one. We'd like to have, if you notice, the logo for this conference is an image of Ada Carina doing some feedback. If you have a good suggestion for an image on sort of more galactic, you know, larger scales showing feedback, and we discussed M82, but I sort of vetoed it because it's such a cliche, right? But if you have something along those lines and would like to suggest it to us, please contact Eve or myself or Roman, or just email it to one of us. Okay. So that's the announcement, and then on to my talk, I think. There we go. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about star formation in self-gravitating turbulent fluids. This work has mostly been done with Phil Chang and Eve Lee, who was an undergraduate student at Toronto, is now a graduate student at Berkeley. And I left off Marc-Antoine Mavel de Chêne, who's in Paris. Okay, so let me just launch right into this. I'm going to talk about a model for star formation and cluster formation. And what I'm trying to get out of this model is essentially the rate of star formation. Depending on, you know, large-scale conditions, right? The density on large scales, the turbulent velocity on large scales, and so forth. And so I'm going to start off by just quickly going through two different pictures of the way people have talked about star formation in the past. The first one is basically goes back to Shu and tries to solve equations directly. And there's another model which depends on the probability distribution function of the density. So I'll describe that in a second. In the sort of Shu picture, which was generalized by the people up here, one of whom Ralph is in the audience. You just write down the continuity equation and the momentum equation, and then you calculate the mass, which determines the gravity at a given radius. This is a 1D model, obviously, and I'm going to be talking about a 1D model. And you either specify the pressure as being due to rho times the sound speed squared, in the case of Shu, or the turbulent velocity squared, or the sum of the two, if you like, in these more general models. And the reason for the generalization was that people realized that if you look at, you know, sort of massive star-forming regions, the line widths you looked at were clearly superthermal. So they were known to be turbulent. The other motivation for the generalization was if you use the sound speed, it's so low in star-forming regions that the star formation rate you can get out of a model like this is very limited. You can explain solar mass stars, but you can't explain higher mass stars. Okay? The turbulent velocities allow you to get around that. All right? What you do is you assume homology. But one of the things I want to point out is that, in fact, people up to now have always assumed that this turbulent velocity is a fixed function of radius. It doesn't depend on time. It's not a dynamical variable. Okay? And essentially what that does is it forces that pressure term to be smaller than the gravity term at small radius, okay, or at small x. Okay? And I want to argue that that's just physically incorrect. Okay? The turbulence knows about the dynamics. All right? The other picture I was talking about here is just a snapshot from one of our 3D simulations, which I won't talk an awful lot about, but a little bit. The point here is that this is a small part of a bigger box. The stars form in these regions where the density is quite high, but the point is that the density, which is what's being plotted here, varies over several orders of magnitude. Here it's very low, there it's very high, and so you get a picture of a distribution function of the density, which typically is log normal, all right? And then you use that information to try to make a theory about how stars form. So here's a plot of a density probability distribution function taken from a really very nice paper from Kurzak et al., which I recommend. They start off with a turbulently stirred box. They keep stirring the box. Initially, they don't have any self-gravity. They turn on the self-gravity, and funny things happen. But I want you to ignore that for the moment. Just this is the log normal distribution you get when there's no self-gravity. Okay? And the idea of these theories of turbulent fragmentation is that, you know, somewhere out here in this high-density tail, gravity's got to win, and you say, okay, that gas turns into stars on a short time scale. So the picture's sort of like that. You take everything above that density, you integrate out to infinity in the density distribution function, and you say that stuff turns into stars. Okay? So Padawan had done this, Krumholtz and McKee, other people have done this. Okay? So that's sort of an alternate picture of how, you know, how to calculate the rate of star formation. Now I'm going to describe a picture, which is much more like the shoot picture than the turbulent fragmentation, okay? And I want to try to convince you, in fact, that that sort of approach is really the right way to go. Right. So this is, so what I'm trying to do here is I'm looking at turbulent simulations, ours and other people's, and trying to extract out of it what is a physical situation that leads to star formation. And if I can get that picture well enough, I think I can then write down equations and say, solve those, and what is a star formation rate? Okay, so that's the sort of trick here. And one of the things I'm going to assert is that, in fact, star-forming regions need not ever be in hydrostatic equilibrium. As far as I can tell, they never are. Okay, and that's definitely not what Shu had assumed in these other pictures. They always assume that you start from a situation of hydrostatic equilibrium. I don't think that, if you look at the simulations, you never see that. Okay. As I sort of pointed out earlier, you really have to treat the turbulence as a dynamical variable. The collapse is going to alter the properties of the turbulence. Okay. The way I'm going to do that is I should really write down an energy equation. But we're talking about turbulent flows. And as you know, if you try to model a turbulent flow from scratch, you're going to spend a long time doing it. Okay? So I don't want to get stuck forever, so I'm going to write down some sort of closure equation. And I'm going to cheat. I'm going to use one that Brant Robertson and Peter Goldreich worked out. Okay? Again, from doing the same sort of technique. They did numerical simulations, looked at the properties of the turbulence, and then extracted out some useful information. So I'm going to use their result for a closure. I'll describe that in the next slide. And what comes out of this is I'll be able to calculate the runoff density, okay? And hence, I can actually calculate the probability distribution function near a star-forming region, okay? I can calculate the infall velocity and the turbulent velocity, both as a function of radius, okay? And I'm going to use some terminology, which I won't explain really well, but hopefully people have seen this. These things tend to be power laws, both of them, okay? And observationally, this one's a power law. The exponent in the power law is usually called P, and it comes in what's called the size-Langlois relation, or one of Larson's laws. And typically, when you observe this in the interstellar medium, P is about a half. Okay. Now, it's been noticed for a long time, about 20 years or more, actually, that if you look in star-forming regions, where you're forming dense, where you have a lot of dense gas and high-mass star formation, P is a lot smaller than a half, and I'll explain why that is, actually. Okay. So that comes out of this theory. And I'll show, in fact, that the pressure, the turbulent pressure, is important throughout the collapse, always, okay? Whereas in previous pictures, the pressure always vanished as you went to small radius or to late times. It never vanishes in these situations, I don't think. Okay. So I want to describe this closure. So this is from Brant and Peter's paper. This is showing on the top here. What they did is, they were doing cosmological simulations in a very small box. They were trying to control, this is a nice controlled experiment, they wanted to control the rate of collapse. Okay, so they just put it in by hand, right? God or Peter or somebody just said, okay, this is the way the collapse is going to go. And if that happens, what will happen to the turbulence? Okay, so they have this thing they call H, which is a Hubble constant, which is, right, A dot over A. And they can just tune that to be whatever they want. They can cause it to collapse, they can cause it to blow up. They did both, actually. And what they found was that this is the turbulent velocity along here, and this is the scale factor. So the scale factor is 0, means you know that's the end of the collapse. Scale factor 1 is at the beginning. So the thing is shrinking. And here the turbulence is decaying. In this run, the turbulence is increasing. And there it goes up and goes down, okay, the turbulent velocity. And these are all three collapses. And whether it decays or goes up or goes down depends on how you treat the scale factor as a function of time, okay? So what they argue, in fact, is, and they show reasonably convincingly, is that what's going on is that turbulence left to its own devices will decay on an eddy turn over time, okay? So that'll tend to cause the turbulent velocity to decrease with time. If you take the turbulence and put it into a collapsing region, you're effectively going to adiabatically heat the turbulence, right? The scale factor is decreasing, the velocity has to increase. It's just the way adiabatic heating works in a thermal situation. And that's what these plots are showing, in fact. That what actually happens then is that the time scale for the eddy turnover time will tend to track the collapse time, okay? In other words, the two time scales involved, the eddy turnover time, which tends to decrease with time, and the infall time scale, they tend to track each other. All right, and that's what these plots are trying to show at the bottom here. In other words, another way to put it is that ratio of the turbulent velocity to the infall velocity goes to a constant. The constant that it goes to depends on the way you collapse, but they go to a constant in any case. Okay, so here's the constant when you have a collapse where the Hubble time is shorter than the Hubble parameter is less than the frequency of the eddy, and here it is if it's bigger than the frequency of the eddy. Okay? All right, so I want to just use this. This is their phenomenological model for how the turbulence evolves, okay, as a closure for the energy equation. All right? So this is just a slide which I think I'm going to skip over, but I'll put it in the slides that I give to KITP, or you can just read Peter and Grant's paper describing how this works, right? This is the scaling due to the scale factor varying. That's effectively driving the turbulence. And here's the normal sort of eddy turnover time decay scale. Okay, 8 is a parameter which describes how the cascade from large scales to small actually works. It's of order unity, okay? Just in, at least in numerical experiments. Okay, so now I'm going to just write down the same set of equations that Xu did, the momentum equation, the continuity equation, the momentum equation, and then this energy equation. And so the goal is just to solve these things, okay? And sort of surprisingly, these are PDEs, they're nonlinear, they're coupled. You can actually just solve these things, essentially, all right? This, I want to define one thing, which is the cluster or star sphere of influence, because this is actually the one bit of physical scale that comes in. And it's pretty straightforward, right? If you have a star or something forming in the center, a star with a disk around it or a cluster of stars, they'll have some mass associated with them, and there's sort of some gravity, but they don't provide you any pressure support, okay? On the other hand, if you then start moving outward in radius, you get more and more gas, and eventually you reach the region where the stellar mass is equal to the enclosed gas mass, okay? That's the sphere of influence of that star cluster or star. And that's a crucial radius. I'll call that R sub star. And it's a time-dependent thing. It depends on the mass in the stars, okay? So I'll talk about things inside the sphere of influence and outside the sphere of influence. And there's a qualitative difference between the two. Okay, so the way to proceed is just to, I should have written a slide out describing what I'm doing here. These various exponents, P prime, kappa rho, I've already mentioned P, this exponent. That's the scaling of the turbulent velocity with radius. Okay, as I said, normally in Larson's law, that's a half. So it's just the logarithmic derivative of the run of the turbulent velocity. P prime is the logarithmic derivative of the infall velocity, okay? And kappa rho is the logarithmic derivative of the density, okay? Now, it turns out these things are actually functions of radius, so the solutions aren't exactly power laws, but if you just think of it as being power laws, you're not going to be too far off, okay? So just let's look at this equation to begin with. You can see I've written them all in a certain way. These are all exponents, and they're going to be varying slowly with radius. Remember, the radius is going to vary by several decades, 3-4 decades, okay? Now, the point is, in all of these, I've written them out so that I've got a time derivative, and then I've got some function of radius, which changes rapidly with radius. And then these things in square brackets are the power law exponents, and they change very slowly with radius, except for this term here, which is essentially the ratio of the gravitational term to either the inertial term, or if you scale it to V turbulent, to the pressure term. Okay? And what I'm going to show you is that inside the sphere of influence, the balance in the momentum equation is between gravity and the inertial terms here. In other words, you just accelerate things. Although it turns out that the pressure term, this term right here, is comparable to the inertial term. If you're outside the sphere of influence, the pressure term is bigger, in fact, than the force of gravity. And the infall speed reduces as you go inward, which is sort of funny, right? Because gravity, you'd think, would be accelerating you, but in fact, you're slowing down because this pressure term is going to be bigger. All right. Now, the next thing you notice is that we're talking about collapse, so the density is going to be increasing as r goes to 0. So look at this term right here. The density is going to turn out to go like 1 over r to the 3 halves. There's a 1 over r here. The velocity can't increase that fast, right? And in fact, if you're inside, the sphere of influence also increases inward. So this thing goes like 1 over r to some large power. Okay, as you go to small radii, this term goes to infinity. You can't move the density in an infinitely short time. This term here has to be bounded. The only way you can have that is if the product of these two, right there, those two terms are 0. Okay? So that immediately tells you a relationship between the run of the density and the run of the infall velocity. All right, this is inside the sphere of influence. But this actually tells you something else really amazing. The sum of these things has to be zero. That means that d rho dt is zero. Okay? If you wait a long enough time, you reach a fixed point in the density. There is a stable attractor in this set of equations. All right? Which to me was really, really interesting. Okay, the density becomes independent of time. Now it turns out you can go through the same argument at large radii, and you get basically the same answer. The density varies on the dynamical time right at the outer radius. Inside of that, the density varies on a time scale, which is much longer than the local free fall time. Okay, so the density just quickly snaps to essentially an attractor, which is really pretty interesting. And I'll show that numerically in a second. Okay. Now you can go through the same sort of argument in the momentum equation, right? Remember I told you that the number is out in front of the momentum equation. This increases inward if you're inside the sphere of influence because this turns out to have a negative dependence on r to the negative power. So again, this term has to vanish at small radius, which means that that term has to vanish at small radius. Okay? And that says that this sum has to vanish. These things are slowly varying. That means that this ratio has to be slowly varying. Okay? So the force of gravity is matching by the rate at which you're accelerating things. And that immediately tells you that how the infall velocity scales. It's not too surprising. If you're inside the sphere of influence of the star or the star cluster, you know, you get basically the Keplerian result. Okay? With the factor this gamma is a constant and it's smaller than 1. Okay? So it's not actually going in at the Keplerian velocity, it just scales the same way. And the reason is because the pressure still does matter. All right? So that immediately tells you that P prime is negative 1/2. And that immediately tells you from the previous slide that kappa rho is 3/2. Okay? All right. And as I point out here, that number is negative, so it's balancing that positive number. So those two things are in balance. Turns out this one's also negative, but it's slightly smaller than that one. Okay? Not by much. All right, so immediately you can conclude something about the mass accretion rate in a system like this. All right? The MDT is 4 pi r squared rho as a function of r and t, and ur as a function of r and t. In the limit of small r, you can just plug in those scalings I showed you, and you get this result. Okay? And it involves this combination of exponents. But that's exactly the combination of exponents that has to vanish at small radius. So the accretion rate is independent of radius inside the sphere of influence of the star or the star cluster. All right? It's not independent of time, because there is a time dependence here. There's no time dependence in the density, but there is in the infall velocity. Because, as I just said, the infall velocity scales like the stellar mass. And that's increasing with time. All right? But this is a differential equation that you can just solve now. The mass goes like t squared, okay, after the star forms. This is a very, very general result. And as far as I can tell, whenever I look at anybody's numerical simulations, this is what they find. They don't always say that, but this is what they're getting. All right. How much more have we got? Okay, good. Well, I can end early. Everybody will be happy if I shut up, right? Right. Yeah, okay, 12. Call it 12, exactly. Okay, I don't want to go too much into large radius because I've been banging my head against how to exactly get this out carefully. You can do it sort of, you know, code up something very simply on the computer to see physically what's going on. I've had a really hard time, so I've been sitting on this result for quite a while, but I think I more or less understand what's going on. At large radii, this is that same combination of exponents that I described earlier. But now I'm thinking about it at large radii when you're outside the sphere of influence of the star. Okay? Now, actually, it turns out then that this term, this is the pressure term, is going to balance the pressure gradient, I should say, term. It's going to balance the term due to gravity. Okay? And it's actually better if you scale this to the turbulent velocity rather than the infall velocity, but I didn't want to confuse people, so I just left it that way. But it turns out then that, and in fact, because of that closure that I described from Brandt and Peter's work, the turbulent velocity and the infall velocity tend to track each other. Not perfectly, but they tend to. Okay. So you still get the same sort of relation, this time between the turbulent velocity and the mass. The difference is, since you're outside the sphere of influence of the star, this isn't the stellar mass, this is effectively the gas mass inside your radius. Okay? So the scalings then are different. Right? The gas mass just scales like kappa rho, sorry, 2 minus kappa rho. You just integrate up r squared times rho. Right? So it should be r squared times rho dr should be 3 minus kappa rho, but there's a 1 over r in here. So you basically get the result that kappa rho is related to P, the Larson's law exponent this way. Okay? Just balancing pressure against gravity. Now, in fact, it's not really a balance. It turns out this term is bigger than that one by factors of 2 or 3. Okay? And the upshot is that the velocity has to slow down. You know, the magnitude of the infall decreases. The magnitude of the infall velocity decreases with the radius. That's in contrast to the case where you're inside the sphere of influence, where the magnitude of the infall velocity increases with decreasing radius. Okay? So out here, it's slowing down. Now, you have to go through some gyrations, but you can actually solve for this exponent P then. It depends on the initial conditions. It depends essentially on the virial parameter of the flow that you describe for your outer boundary conditions. But basically, it comes out to be of order 0.2, substantially smaller than the Larson's law that you see in the absence of self-gravity. Okay, so I think this is a really important result, because this is, in fact, what people tend to see in rapidly star-forming regions. So they see this very slow dependence on radius of the turbulent velocity or the turbulent line width. Okay? And I think this is why. Essentially, what's going on, right, is that because we have an energy equation, the collapse, well, there's actually two things to say. Right? Stars form not in just some random region. They form in regions where the gas is coming in, which is sort of obvious, because if the gas is going out, you're not going to form a star, right? You form a star when the gas is coming in. It's coming in with some positive kinetic energy. Now, it turns out that at large radius, the kinetic energy is bigger, typically, than the binding energy inside it at early times. Late times, the binding energy becomes significant. But in any case, you have a situation where you've got free energy coming in a turbulent fluid. And it's not that surprising. You're going to convert some of that free energy into turbulent motions. Okay? So you're driving the turbulence, either from gravitational potential energy at late times or at early times just from the infalling gas being, you know, turbulently stirred. There's instabilities in the infall. Okay? And so what that means is that the eddies which are trying to decay due to their internal, you know, dissipational processes, they're being driven. And so they don't decay as rapidly with radius as they would in a case where there isn't any source of free energy. Right? But you have to have an energy equation to see this in your physics. Okay. So here's just a couple of picture snapshots, and I'll show a movie real quick, because the movie's really cool. I mean, it's sort of a stupid movie that I made myself, but it's kind of cool to watch. Okay. All right. So this on the left here is essentially, this is radius, a logarithmic scale. There's the negative of the inflow velocity. It's really fuzzy. I'm not sure why. Anyway, the blue line here is the infall velocity, and the sort of green dashed line is the turbulent velocity. And you can see they track each other. There's some funny business out here because I don't know how to do my initial conditions properly. But the infall velocity first increases a little bit, and then it decreases as you go in. And here's the sphere of influence, essentially, of the star. Okay, and that's the 1 over r squared scaling there. So both the turbulent velocity and the infall velocity decrease inward, and then they increase inward. And the density is just practically a power law. If you look carefully, there's a little bit of a kink right there. Not much. Okay? So you can actually solve for the exponent out here. It's slightly bigger than 3 halves. It's maybe 1.6, 1.7, as opposed to in here, where it really is 1.5. This is the mass accretion rate as a function of radius. It's large on the outside. And it decreases, and then it goes dead flat. And this, again, is the sphere of influence. Okay? So let me show you my little movies here. Okay. First, I'll show you the density and the velocity. Okay. So this is, the top one is the density, scaled to the outer density. You can see it basically gives you a power law after a certain time. This is the velocity again. Oh, now I'm showing the next one. Oh, okay, cute. Let me go back. Just stop it. Okay, so we started it with some, well, maybe I'll back it up a little bit. Can't get all the way to the beginning, but you can see we started with a uniform density, and then with time, it starts to steepen up. okay? And the infall velocity, we just had some, we were shooting gas in with some turbulent velocity, but we had zero velocity initially. I mean, it dropped off like some power law, okay? So if you watch the movie, you see that it immediately snaps to this attractor that I've mentioned, okay? And the density after that just stays fixed, independent of time, which is what the equations say it ought to do. You can see it is evolving with time. What's happening is, I don't know why it's doing that. Let me just stop it when it goes in. Okay. Okay, so this, you can see when I run the movie again, this kink here is going to be moving outward. And there's a slight bend up here, which you can just barely see. And that's just the sphere of influence going out as the star accretes more mass. Okay. Now, the other movie is just the M dot. And what you can see there is that when we get there, is that M dot starts off being zero at zero, but then eventually you get enough density to the inside to start, you know, feeding gas to the star. But what will happen is this region here inside the sphere of influence, that'll come out, it'll increase with time, and the radius of the sphere of influence will increase with it. So this is the way it looks. Okay? All right. Enough of that. Okay, so I would say that the fact that the problem exhibits an attractor for the density and for the velocity outside the sphere of influence, you saw outside the sphere of influence, the velocity really doesn't change much, okay? You can adjust that by picking different boundary conditions, but by and large, it's pretty much an attractor, okay? That, I think, is actually really good news, right? It means that we should be able to capture the behavior of this system and put it into a subgrid model that you can put into a cosmological simulation. So I've been thinking about how to do this. It's actually pretty straightforward. You can just write down the mass accretion rate. Okay, so basically I think you just need to be able to see these converging flows in tumor mass GMCs. That's really the criterion you have to do. You have to somewhat resolve a GMC, and I think then you're done, probably. Now I should say a few caveats about, this is a simple 1D model, and it will overestimate the mass accretion rate. Because in real life, right, the gas isn't just all falling in shells. Some of it's going in and some of it's going out. But it doesn't change qualitatively what's going on. It reduces the star formation rate by, you know, substantial amounts, but it doesn't actually change the way the thing behaves. This is just a plot showing this Larson's law index as a function of radius. You can actually work out analytically what it should go like. This is this dashed line here, and the dotted line at large radius, okay? And this is the numerical solution. You can see I'm being stupid out here at the outside. But, you can pretty well understand analytically what's going on, okay? And this sort of feature here just moves out with time, all right? So that's the size-length relation. All right, so now you want to do a little bit to, you know, does this have anything to do with what we see in the simulations? And then there's another step, which is, does it have anything to do with reality? So the first thing that I can say is this thing predicts that if you take the power spectrum of the turbulence, it should be very different in collapsing regions than in non-collapsing regions. You should be able to see that the turbulent velocity in collapsing regions differs from that in non-collapsing regions. You can see the density probability distribution should have a power law tail. This is pointed out by Kritzak. But now you can actually calculate what the exponents are and why. Okay. It'll give you the infall velocity. At large radius, it turns out the exponent here is pretty close to the one for the turbulent velocity. It's not quite the same, but it's of the same order. And that the mass should go like T squared. So we've checked all these things in our simulations. Okay, so this is just a plot of the power spectrum around, you know, if you just do this over the whole box, you never see anything, right? People have looked for these sorts of effects in simulations before by taking an FFT of the whole box, and you don't see these effects. But if you look at subregions where the stars are actually forming, you can actually see that this is the average of a bunch of points in a box not associated with star-forming regions. Actually, they're just random, so one of them could have been. And the power spectrum drops off in our simulations. If you look around collapsing regions, you have a lot of excess power, not surprisingly on small scales, right? This one's a little, yeah. Yes. I don't want to waste time right now, but I can talk about it afterwards. It's not a trivial operation. That's why I showed you both in near turbulence and not near turbulence. So that in addition to that effect, right, this tells you immediately you don't have to worry about that. There's something else going on. Okay, I gotta hurry up, 1 minute. There's just, you see these runs of velocity. I won't go into that much. We see the same probability distribution function, blah, blah, blah. Everybody sees this sort of thing. We actually can make movies out of this, and you do see that you see the subtractor in the density if you look around collapsing regions. Okay. The star formation does go like T squared. Self-gravity, this is the last thing I'll say, is crucial. Okay, you get these T squared type behavior if you have self-gravity on it. If you turn off the self-gravity of the gas, you actually just reproduce this picture of collapse in the probability distribution function. You get a linear growth in the star formation rate. That's these points down here. And it's too small by orders of magnitude at any given time. Okay, this is the picture where you just take the density above some threshold and turn into stars. This turns out to give you of order, you know, percent for free fall time, but that's an adjustable thing. You just adjust your density threshold. But it's linear and not T squared. So self-gravity really does matter. Okay, so since I'm out of time, I will leave it there.
Let's thank the speaker. So Norm, one question I have is, so the scaling relations that you developed were developed in a system without feedback.
And that's correct.
So do you have any feel, so some of these scaling relations are clearly not going to hold if feedback were included. Do you have any feel for how that might go, especially because I'm certain that the simulations that you've looked at that show mass dependence going as T squared are probably systems that did not have feedback in them
actually,
in the simulations.
No, that's not true, actually. In fact, so we've done it with feedback and without. And here are some simulations by Wang et al. Back in 2010 and by the Berkeley group, Myers et al. And they point out in their papers, both of them, you guys in particular, that these are super linear. These are star formation. This is stellar mass as a function of time, and it's super linear. And those have at least jet feedback in the simulations.
They had jet and radiation.
And radiation,
so that's
yeah.
Interesting.
So the answer is it's robust against that. And I think you can actually understand why physically. Now this story can't be true forever, because you don't see GMCs that have nothing but stars in them. Okay, so there is some feedback process which will interrupt this. And that, of course, is one of the discussions in this workshop. So my student, Libby Harper-Clark, several years ago, did simulations like this where we saw this scaling, which I didn't understand at the time. But then when we put in either H2 gas pressure or radiation pressure, we'd see this scaling up to a certain time, and then it'd roll off, essentially because you blew the gas away. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I think something along those lines is what's going on. That these scalings are there, the feedback, at least the simulations I've seen, doesn't tune itself to match the to modify the accretion rate so that it's steady. It either works or it doesn't. It either cuts off completely.
Of course, right.
Well, it doesn't. It could have settled into a steady state in principle, but at least I haven't seen any results that look like that.
Yeah. Okay, Steffi.
You're saying that you compare with simulations using magnetic fields, right?
Yeah.
MHT. So what's the effect of the magnetic field? Because you don't really include it in the analytical prescription.
I didn't in this, just to keep it simple. You can put in the sound speed, it doesn't make any difference. You can put in magnetic fields, and it does slow because it gives you an additional pressure support. But it tends to scale the same way as the turbulent velocities. So it's slow, it does reduce the rate of star formation. In the simulations, what you typically see is it reduces it by a factor of 2 at any given time after the stars form. It also tends to change the time when the stars first form. But I'm just talking about the scaling after the first stars form. It tends to slow the accretion rate because you got added pressure support, so that's not really surprising. It doesn't qualitatively change things. You still get the same T squared scaling because eventually gravity is going to win, and that's that sphere of influence is going to increase, and that gives you this. And as far as I can tell, the magnetic fields don't change that attractor for the density. It doesn't care. That comes out of it comes out of Keplerian motion, gravity being dominant, and the continuity equation. So it doesn't really care. If there's a collapse, it'll go like T squared.
Norm, just a quick comment and a question. Quick comment about numerical simulation showing everything time dependent, true, but as we all know, there's a lead up to a critical Bonner-Ebert sphere or even an SIS.
No, there isn't.
You can gradually
hydrostatic equilibrium.
Go through a series of quasi-equilibrium states before you become critical and
we
collapse.
We don't see that in our simulations when we look.
That's to be determined, I think.
That's a statement. We look,
okay.
In our simulations, we do not see it. It may not be true in other people's simulations, but as far as I can tell, there is no hydrostatic
Okay, but if you just go way back to Larson, that series of nice little steps up towards something that collapses, I think could probably be found in simulation. That's not my point. Your very nice analysis here. I wonder, that relation you write down for the closure relation for turbulence, is there a physical picture behind this, that how this turbulence is actually being excited by collapse? I think Hennebel and Klessen have also talked about, you know, a collapse-driven turbulence as well, but...
No, this is a very much a Peter Goldreich argument, right? Which means you don't understand how it works, but it's right, okay? The argument is, right, that the eddy will tend to decay. Its turbulent velocity will decay with time unless it's driven, okay? Even if you drive it at large scales, right, you have a cascade of energy through. And if you just leave it like that, you'll get, you know, the velocity will decay with time during the collapse. In the collapse, you're trying to, you know, so here's the part where you have to sort of believe in a little bit of magic. The collapse is supposed to drive turbulence. Now, when people do simulations, they see this. I mean, Grant did this. Other people have seen this as well. If you start with really smooth initial conditions, I think Christoph Federat did this, you don't get much growth in the turbulence, but that assumes, you know, very smooth initial conditions, which isn't realistic. If you put in non-smooth initial conditions, you drive turbulence. Now, how that works is not understood. But the fact that it settles down onto this state where the time scale for the eddy turnover matches the infall time, that is essentially, you know, adiabatic invariance gives you a time scale, tells you that those two time scales should match.
Hi. Yeah. It's really interesting. So I was wondering, the existence of this attractor that you see may suggest that there's an universality in the IMF. So we've seen that this appears not to be the case. So can you speculate a little bit what may actually then sort of change if you have to change the IMF?
I think the work that Richard and Mark and other people have done has sort of shown how, in fact, the IMF really does depend on the rate of accretion, right? If you make the accretion really fast, you get a lot of high mass stars. If you make it slower, the break in the IMF in their simulations at least varies with that time scale because it affects the temperature of the gas and that affects the thermal properties. And at least in their picture, which I think is correct probably to zeroth order, that's what sets the break in the IMF. So yeah, you can have a universal inflow, but the rate of accretion varies with time. It also depends on the rate at which you're shooting gas at the thing in the first place. So that could change the IMF in principle. Now whether it actually does is another question. But so just because you have a universal density profile and a universal evolution of the velocity doesn't mean you're going to have the same IMF all the time.
Jim? So when you write down sort of a mean field equation at the very beginning with a turbulent velocity and a radial velocity, I think you're sort of implicitly assuming there's a scale separation between the turbulence orders of magnitude smaller than the velocity field, so you can just sort of average over states and treat it like a pressure.
Yes.
But here, the turbulent velocity field is at the scale of the flow, and there's no distinction between VR and V turbulent.
Yep.
How does the model work? I mean,
Dan DeFino.
Sorry?
Dan DeFino. Right? I agree with you. The averaging doesn't really make an awful lot of sense.
So
the model seems to describe what you see in the simulations fairly well.
So, Norm.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, so you have a model for sort of how density varies with time. It seems like you could make an important observational comparison, which is we know a lot about the relationship between star formation rates and the luminosities of tracers that are density sensitive. So,
right.
I mean, the most famous example is HCN, but you know, many other things have been looked at. And there's a ton of observational data. So it seems like you could, for your model, make predictions about how the star formation rate should scale with the luminosities of each of these tracers if star formation comes from an ensemble of things that look like, you know, one of your collapsing clouds.
Yeah, exactly.
Have you made that check? Does it work?
No. It took me a long time to figure out. As you can imagine, I've been stumped with this for quite some time.
Okay, because it seems like there's potentially at least a difficulty in that. I mean, I'm not sure I followed.
I'm sure there are many potential difficulties.
In your model, once gas gets to a density of, say, 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5, right, it seems like it pretty quickly then turns into stars. So you don't, gas at densities that are that high, doesn't linger for a long time.
No, this is a fixed point in the density. So there's always density at that. There's always gas at that density at any time.
Sure. No, but the point I wanted to make is that you need there to be a lot of gas at that density, right? You need it to be the case that the amount of mass at that density is equal to the star formation rate times something like 100 times the
free. It's a run of density.
Okay.
We know there's a run of density.
Yeah. So it's the
right? And the run of density that people infer is pretty much the one that's coming out of these simulations and out of the theory.
Okay, but if not necessarily the one that exists in nature, is the
point. No, that's what I'm saying. If you look at the observational estimates, as best people can do, of the runs of density, it's between r to the minus 1 and r to the minus 2. Right?
Okay, we're going to have to take one more question, Patrick, and then get on to the next speaker.
Yeah, I wonder about angular momentum. I mean, when you have when you have a turbulent flow, okay, it contains unavoidably some angular momentum.
Absolutely.
Of course, that should be conserved, and that's not going to be described by the equation you show.
That's correct.
It's just okay. And the problem is that after some contraction, the gas contracts sufficiently, it's going to be dominant.
Yes, I showed a plot of that actually. Pritzok noticed this numerically. What it'll do is it become rotationally supported.
Yeah.
It'll happen at a fairly small radius, and then I'm happy with that.
What do you call small
because
radius?
Because at that point, you say the whole rotationally supported thing is your star cluster or what I'm calling this inner radius. Because that gas, which is rotationally supported, will form a disk pretty quickly. It won't provide any pressure support anymore. It'll act like a star or star cluster. It's now a source of gravity, but it's not a source of pressure support. And so you just move your inner boundary to that radius. And because it's an attractor, the density still stays the same. Because the m dot inside the sphere of influence is independent of radius, the fact that your rotation is supported at a larger radius than the star doesn't make any difference. The accretion rate is still the same. Yeah,
okay, thank you. Let's thank Norm again. Okay. Our next speaker is Steffi Walsh, and it's the life cycle of molecular clouds and Milky Way disk-like galaxies.